Hi, my name is Bruce Perham. Welcome to my podcast series, Trauma from the Frontline. In this series, we'll be interviewing a wide range of people that work in the frontline industries who will be sharing their professional and personal thoughts and ideas about working in the field and some of the challenges that they all confront. So welcome to the podcast, Trauma from the Frontline. This is Bruce Perham here, your interviewer. And today I've got Don Gillies, who has agreed to share his story. He was a policeman for 5 years and then worked as a paramedic for 37 years. So he's going to talk a little bit about his experience as, of both professions. Welcome, Don. Maybe the first question for you is what led you towards the police all those years ago? And if you could tell us a little bit about that.
I joined when I was 17. I started as a cadet. Police cadet. They existed for about 20 or 25 years in the 60s and 70s. So it was a very young age to join. Where I grew up in Mount Waverley in Victoria, there was in my cohort at school, there was a large number of guys that went into the army, the police force, the navy, those sorts of things. And so I kind of just rolled into that. I thought, okay, this looks like a good thing. I applied and was accepted in February 77.
So how did you find the training experience?
The training at the time was excellent. I was, as were all of us, were very young and keen and fit and healthy, and it was good. It was at that time, it was the cadets was all male. In fact, the cadets went right through its entire existence as male only. Officers. Then in December of 77, I went out to the police academy and started the section of training out there, and that was in a mixed group, obviously. And then in May of 1978, went out on the road and as a trainee, and my very first station was Port Melbourne in the era of the painters and dockers.
So right, okay.
Straight into it.
Yeah. So what was that first year like as being a young police officer?
It was great. It was absolutely fantastic. The sense of camaraderie I enjoyed the training, the physical demand of the training, those activities, just absorbed it like a sponge. I was very, very happy with that time.
Wow. So what sorts of things were you doing? Were you on the road or?
No, with the cadets, there was two types of cadets. One stream was called vocational, which was working in police stations, doing not going out on the road, but doing support jobs within the police stations and the like. And the other stream was referred to as academic, and we actually did VCE, Year 12 Matric, whatever it was called at the time. Yeah. And the idea was, I guess, to have a variation in the skills of people going into the academy and ultimately out on the road.
Mm-hmm. So where did that career, where did that take you within the police?
With the police, I did general duties for most of it. I spent about a year in the city in what was called the Traffic and Patrol Division standing on the street corners directing traffic, if you remember that era.
Yes, I do.
With the white gloves and the white shirt sleeves up over the vest. And that actually was an amazing experience, having to be at street level dealing with people, all sorts of people, from tourists to vagrants to drug addicts to you name it. We stood on the street corner and it came to us. It was quite an education.
Mm-hmm. So how long did you do that for?
That was a bit over a year, and then I went to Fitzroy Police Station, which was the smallest police sub-district in the state at the time. I don't know how they divide things these days, but yeah, I, with my nature and the way that my training had sort of set me up, I thought, right, I want to go somewhere where it's really all happening. So I went to an extremely busy inner city station.
And what sort of experiences did you have there?
That's, I think, when I look back, that's where certainly all of the seeds for my ultimate issues with my mental health were all, I can pinpoint them to that period.
Right. What sorts of things were happening, Don?
That's where I came across my first fatal collisions and the backstory behind those, how things occurred. I had a number of firearm events, one where I was wrestling with an individual for a .22 rifle that went up under my chin. The trigger was pulled. You could hear the click of the firing pin driving home, and ultimately wrestled that off him. And when we checked the weapon, there was a round in it, and it had been struck, but it didn't go off.
Wow.
And that one, I know later that day when I got home, I hadn't thought about it at all up until it was like just part of the job. And then when I got home, it just washed over me, just the entire situation. And then I was involved in a collision with a police. I was driving a police vehicle, was involved in a collision that did not go well, and the other driver had some fairly serious injuries, and I was treated quite harshly by the senior administration of the area, and those two events, I think, were the beginning. I know that I felt a change in myself at that time.
Did you you know, when you had those two events, you know, did you have any idea of what you were going to be exposed to in being a police officer? And
not really. At that time, anything that occurred to you as an individual was just considered part of the job. And there were no support mechanisms in place, no diffusing, no anything. Unfortunately, at the time, pretty much alcohol was seen as the only diffusing mechanism within some members of the force. You know, drinking at the time was very heavy. Yeah.
With that incident, wrestling with the firearm, and obviously you could have been seriously injured in that.
Yes.
Was that the first time that you'd had a sense of, I could really be hurt here. This could be quite a dangerous yes. situation.
Yeah, at the time, let me think. I was I would have been 20 by then, and that I think the part of it was this sudden wash of mortality. It was suddenly, hang on, I in this job I could be killed or injured. It was an absolute reality check. Up until then, I think to a degree with the training, when I look back on it, we were encouraged to believe that we were not unable to be injured, but we were we would overcome everything, and that didn't balance out with the reality in the long run.
So there wasn't the awareness back then, or wasn't the training towards, you know, this is a high risk occupation?
It was a long time ago, so trying to remember that training. But I think it was, I think as I said, it's was kind of the almost like shit happens. If you can't handle that, get
part
out.
Part of the job.
It was, it's this is the job, take it or leave it.
Yes.
You know, it was just expected.
How did you personally process that? You know, you said you got home and, lots of thoughts. How did you work that through? And obviously you got back to work.
I think ultimately the events that were occurring around that time in the late 70s and then when I went into ambulance in the early 80s, I didn't cope. I didn't process. I just shoved things to the back. You know, a familiar process for so many people, just ignore it and it'll go away, which we know is a very, very bad tactic. I was drinking reasonably heavily at the time. I no longer drink, at that time. There was very much the was made kind of made known that you don't talk about it, you don't air it. So there was nobody really to turn to officially or formally. Now, my senior sergeant at that time, he became my mentor. He was a wonderful man who's no longer with us, unfortunately. Cancer took him some years ago. We sat down. He could tell I was not doing well, and he called me and closed the office door and was the first person ever to say, "Are you okay? You know, what, something's not right about you." And I was able to open up to him, and he was actually the first person that gave me the idea that perhaps the police force wasn't my future. He sort of looked to the future and went, these events will continue. Who knows what, but these type of events will continue, and potentially you're not going to deal with that. So let's look at alternatives. And we discussed things, and the ambulance service, we felt that fitted perhaps my personality better, because I felt I got a lot from the elements of the police role where I was assisting people, albeit, you know, as a result of them having a crime committed against them, or just in an interaction with them in general, whereas the side of going out and catching crooks, as a phrase, was not the most appealing element. So I moved from Fitzroy to the Box Hill Police Station. We sort of stepped out of the fire a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to ask, before we go on to that, Don, how did you take that feedback personally that, well, maybe you're not, you know, sort of cut out for this type of work? How did you respond to that?
Because of how it was delivered, which was in absolute truth and from a place of care, it resonated. It was like, okay, I hadn't necessarily had that thought myself that you need to get out, but Viv, the senior sergeant, was, by having that said to me, it kind of flipped the switch and started me thinking along those lines. So, had it been somebody just saying, oh, mate, you need to get out, you're not right for this, I might have reacted against that and dug my heels in, I don't know.
Right.
But, yeah, the way that it was delivered and who it came from really resonated. And as I said, he remained my mentor for many years, even when I went into the ambulance service. Right. I modelled myself on his style of life. He was such a wonderful man.
Do you think that was sort of in a way what he was reflecting to you, was that you're too sensitive or too compassionate, or, you know, that it's going to wear you down?
I think potentially so. I mean, that is in my nature and the nature of so many of my colleagues that I've met over the years in ambulance and in police, is that there is a common thread generally of, compassion, empathy, and even putting yourself in harm's way for the greater good, which I know sounds very altruistic, but it's there.
Well, and it's what you were doing.
Yeah. And I think if you were to interview 100 paramedics, 100 police officers, 100 firefighters, that type of thing, SES, all those, you would find they would express some of those elements in their discussion about their personality. I think you need to have that to do the job, but also to even consider stepping into any of those roles. There has to be that particular mindset to even trigger the thought of entering those roles, because there's nobody there doing it for the money.
No, and I guess that touches on that fine line between being motivated to do that sort of work, but the looking after yourself in the process. Was that difficult to do?
Yes, because looking after yourself isn't something that comes naturally, if that makes sense.
Yes, so, it does.
What is being done now with the various services in the training and I think in society in general through schools and schooling, we're trying to teach people how to self-care, to even know that there is such a thing as self-care. And there was none of that. So I had nothing to draw from. I had no tools available that I knew of to begin looking after myself.
And is that where the alcohol filled the void?
Yes, very much so. Alcohol and I'll use the term risk-taking behaviour, but not in a a wild, crazy sense, but in the sense that you would be prepared to do anything. There was no particular fear of rock climbing, parachuting, scuba diving, all these high risk activities. And I think some of that, looking back now and having spoken for many years now with psychologists and psychiatrists, that there is inherent in first responders of a long duration almost a need to continue to get adrenaline surge. There's this constant need to be on the edge, because you spend so much time at work poised in any of the immediate first responder roles, you know, police, fire, ambulance, etc. You go to work, figuratively clock on, and for the next 8, 10, 14 hours, whatever the shift duration is, you have absolutely no idea what's going to happen. And so there's an immediate switch to get your senses heightened up that, okay, I need to be ready for whatever walks through the door or whatever I drive around the corner and find, whatever happens when the pager goes off. And when these jobs occur, that allows that that build-up off, for me personally, allowed that build-up to wash off. So you go home at the end of the shift, maybe a bit tired, but you could be fulfilled because the job's gone well or whatever. Some days you'd go to work in ambulance, and for the duration of a shift, you don't turn a wheel. Not a single job comes in. It's very, very, very rare these days, but you know, in the past that would occur. And you would go, again, I would go home from those shifts and be absolutely wiped out because I'd been dialed up for the entire shift and nothing happened. There was nothing to release that that chemical buildup, that psychological preparation. And that you'd come home kind of exhausted and wired at the same time.
So it's almost like being all dressed up but nowhere to go. That I really understand what you're saying, Don, in terms of that you to do your job, you have to be on high alert, you have to be hyper-vigilant, you have to be ready to go. And I really get that you're all fired up and nothing happens. You've got that no release. Would you look back now and say that in a way the adrenaline was good, but in a way it was harming you at the same time, you know, a little bit of rob Peter to pay Paul, you know?
Absolutely. And there's a lot of studies in place, and there are some conflicting studies that show that the adrenaline and cortisol interactions over long periods, so decades, which obviously I had four plus decades of it, actually does physiologically alter the body, and that it ties in this physiological change has an impact on the mental health and where the mind goes and sits itself over that long period of time as well.
At the time, did you have any awareness of that?
No, not at all.
So what did you think was happening to you?
It's an interesting question because looking back, I can't recall exactly how I felt. I just part of it. And again, you talk to people that work, like I worked shift work all my life. I guess you rationalise. I do remember thinking a lot of times that I feel dreadful, or I feel physically and mentally wrung out, I'm stuffed. It's just the shift work. It's very easy to just rationalise it off and just go, it's the shifts, that's all it is. So you don't really think too deeply about it. It wasn't until I really became concerned about my level of drinking, my mindset, my interaction with my wife and my children, that, yeah, I with all of their input, with all of their help, I realised that I am, something is absolutely not right here, and that's when I started getting some help and seeing psychologists and medication and the like.
At what point was that, Don, in your career?
I would have been the late, mid, yeah, excuse me, mid to late 90s. So it had been nearly 20 years, thereabouts, of just thinking, it'll be okay, she's right, this is my life now. The ambulance service set up, and for a number of reasons I'm a little bit hazy about that period, and so I get some of the years wrong, but the ambulance service established the what's called VACU, the Victorian Ambulance Crisis Council Unit, and it was set up by a Dr. Robin Robinson. And she was just an amazing lady, and her legacy still rolls on in that sector of the ambulance. And I saw her, and she's the one that actually diagnosed and said, you have PTSD. Her specialty prior to ambulance was, she, you know, you imagined that era in the 90s, she was dealing with a lot of Vietnam veterans and had been for some years. And my early years in the police force, there was lots of Vietnam veterans. And her comment at one point is that my level of PTSD, where I was and the situation that I was in, was akin to, if not greater than, what she was seeing in long-term combat veterans from Vietnam.
Did you have any idea of PTSD, of what was happening to you, or the severity of what was happening to you?
I'd never heard of it. Up to that point, I had no idea. It was, it was more, I went to see the psychologist because I thought I was nuts. But, you know, just putting it very bluntly, I thought, oh, there's something's wrong. And once Robin diagnosed it, went, right, this is where we are, then I went and saw my GP, and on Robin's recommendation, had a very frank discussion with my GP at the time, and went on to antidepressants and thought, right, that's it for the rest of my life. And so I didn't do anything more than that for a number of years, and I still drifted in and out of phases of drinking heavily, which never goes well with antidepressants and other meds of that nature. And that rolled through. So I was still, as you can imagine, every year, or, you know, that there would be, the terminology I use is sentinel events, where there would be dreadful experiences that are still there, you know, children in road trauma, you know, family-based homicides, just horrible things that they would continue to just that they would be there. I would think, okay, I'm on antidepressants. I'll be fine. This will, you know, this too shall pass. And it rolled through until 2016. I was in an ambulance by myself in a regional area, heading out to do some work in a remote regional area of Eastern Victoria, and I had stopped off at a branch station. I had bumped into a friend and colleague who was involved in our peer system, had a brief interaction with him indirectly, and he rang me in the vehicle to say, look, you didn't look right, you didn't sound right. And that broke me. I had to pull the ambulance over to the side of the road, had a full breakdown, and I haven't been in an ambulance since. That was the end of me. And that's when I then started seeing a psychiatrist and another psychologist, and started getting my medications adjusted, because they hadn't been changed for 20-odd years. So
looking back, Don, can you put into words, you know, what you think happened that day?
It was it's a hard question, because that whole day parts of it are clear as crystal and others are very fudgy. But I just remember speaking with Ross on the phone, and it was literally like an emotional dam breaking. I had to pull the ambulance over to the side of the road. I had no strength left. I was just sobbing. Everything was black. It felt like everything was black. I felt pointless. I remember at that time not being suicidal as such, but just thinking, well, this is it. There's no lower point. I just wish I wasn't here. It was an absolute bottom out. Now, I'd sort of swung low in the past, but I had no idea, no concept of the depth of despair until that day. And as I said, that was the end of my career.
As the days went on, Don, what things surfaced for you in terms of that, what sounds like just that emotional release of all of the pent up experiences? Did particular thoughts come back to you? Or
yes, yeah, I was having the as occurs with so many people, you know, with their PTSD, is the living the flashbacks. That breaking down of the barriers, that all of the walls, all of the doors that I'd shoved everything behind over the decades just were all gone. And so I was very, very raw, and having the flashbacks, and not like people sitting there remembering their holidays or remembering a nice event. With my PTSD flashbacks, and as is described by so many people, you're not remembering it, you live it. Your body goes back there, and the emotions and sensations that were experienced at the time are there again. And they can come at any time, awake, asleep, driving, not necessarily triggered by any particular event, but sometimes can be if something happens suddenly that is similar to one of these events.
Don, were you having nightmares and flashbacks before 2016? Were you experiencing that, but in a way that you felt you were able to manage?
Yes. They weren't as graphic, I guess. And again, kind of because they had been part of my life for so long, it was you kind of accepted the fact that, okay, this is my life now. I'm going to have bad dreams. I'm going to have issues with memories. That's something that first responders in the rural areas very much live the dream, because you'll constantly be driving past locations and houses and things where you go, oh yeah, that happened there, that happened there. You've almost got to consciously switch yourself off driving through certain locations. So I just thought, oh yeah, that's how life is. Since seeking, just reaching out and getting all the help that I could get my hands on, I've worked through understanding that a lot of this can be mitigated. I still occasionally will have almost like a little internet GIF, just a little 2 or 3 second memory of things, as opposed to the full-blown flashbacks. And I've done, since 2016, as part of my personal development, my emotional growth, I've done yoga, mindfulness, meditation, doing music, doing music as a therapy, things like that, and using grounding strategies. So if I feel that I'm starting to wind up a bit, or if I feel like here's a bit of a flashback, I've got this this range of strategies that I can dive into and work on myself. Whereas 20 years ago, it was nothing. It was like strap in, Drew. Here's the ride. You've just got to get to the end of this. Whereas now, I feel like I'm actually able to physically and consciously do something to work on those issues. And if we lead in, Bernie has been a big part of that.
Has there been, as a part of that process, and I really, it's a very strong message of the importance of having that sort of structure in your life. In the years since 2016, has it been a process of processing some of that emotion that erupted that day? It's almost like, as you said, you've got all this emotion and feelings that you had at the time that were bottled.
Yes.
Has it been, I would imagine, a challenging process to start to go back and connect with the emotional experience?
Oh, absolutely. And it's being helped to get to a point where you give yourself permission to go back through this minefield of memories. The, you know, as I said, figuratively, the whole time you're just shoving these things behind you. I don't want to think about it, don't want to see it, don't want to know. And so you've been telling yourself, telling your brain, don't go there, don't think about it, block it down. And now you're saying, okay, let's bring it up. Let's work through it. I did a 10-week outpatient course at the Melbourne Clinic Psych Hospital. And I worked with a wonderful psychologist there through EMDR, which it's eye movement something. The DR's gone out of
me. I know what you mean.
Yeah. But it's a practice that apparently was developed around the time of Vietnam veterans starting to appear with issues, and it relates to basically giving the eyes a focus while thinking about something different, and that allows the mind, I don't know how, but it allows the mind to go freely to places that you normally would block. And working with Annie over those 10 weeks, we absolutely smashed through some walls, and there's a lot of tears, a lot of very powerful and overwhelming emotions. But doing that in a safe place, in a controlled environment, with someone trusted, was huge, and that really did a lot for me. But we tried, hypnotism was tried by three, four different people on me, and it was interesting. Some people swear by it. I found zero effect whatsoever with the hypnotism, which was interesting. But
so have you been able to, Don, in a way it sounds like you've been able to connect a bit more with the emotionalism of what you experienced in your work. Is that got you in a more comfortable place?
Yes. I think key to literally what you just said is experiencing the emotion of the job. Part of what creates the problem is that at the job, at these sentinel events that all the first responders go to, for the duration of that event, we must remain professional. We must do our job. We must make sure that everybody's safe, the environment's good, that whatever our practices and protocols are for whichever organisation, that's all being done. So there is actually no time for and no place to a degree for emotion to the degree that everybody else who's experiencing that situation, the people involved, emotion is what's driving them, and it's the one thing that we can't allow in there. So you then finish the job, go back, restock the vehicle, clean up, do all of the paperwork, do all that sort of thing, and you may then be immediately sent on another job. So there is no time or place for that emotion to be released. So that's where in my situation there was that first huge burst, and then over the years since then, as I've gone through different therapies and dealt with different people, psychologists and my psychiatrist, I've been able to, we've looked at about a dozen main events, key events that were my real troublesome ones. And I've worked through the emotions and the anxieties and the stresses of each of those, again, in a safe, controlled environment with a trusted person. That had I not reached out and had Ross not done the very simple phone call saying, "Are you okay?" I may have continued on a bit further, but it was inevitable that some form of explosive event was going to occur, and it just happened to be on the 10th of May 2016. That'll sit there forever.
I think it will, and I guess it's a trusted person asking you that question, that obviously you couldn't avoid the answer in that I'm just not traveling okay.
Yeah.
Looking back, Don, is there anything that you would think might have helped you in that journey? You know, what thoughts do you have about what would have been helpful for you in the journey? What might have made a difference?
At the time, as I've said, just the ignorance of self-care and what was available. I'm pleased to be able to say, certainly in ambulance, and I know in police, within the organisations, that they are improving constantly, which is good, but teaching and training their staff and the management in regards to mental health and self-care. Had those things been available, I would like to hope I would have reached out for them. A better understanding of the fact that we're not superhuman, you know, first responders aren't superhuman. The things that are available now, the capacity and being able to say, "I'm taking a couple of days off and it's for my mental health and I'm going to see my doctor or whatever," it's that type of thing. That's what I think would have done had it been available, had it been.
And is there an element of needing to be aware of the reality of this work can have emotional impact, that the putting it aside is what's the word, a bit at your own peril?
Yes. Yeah. I don't think we can sit there and say that there's some form of psychological testing that we can do to make sure that we get the right people. I think touching back on what I said earlier, it's almost a yin and yang thing, that the right people for doing the role are quite possibly the people who are the more vulnerable to the downside of the role. It's a very delicate balance.
But I totally agree. It's almost like, you know, we're lured into it because of our commitment to people and wanting to make a difference. But
yes,
it's going to bite us at the same time.
Yeah, and that's there's societal changes may have an impact on this, in the sense that when my generation, I'm in my 60s now, we would view the the first response, police, fire, ambulance, as a lifetime job. Whereas now there's the I believe studies out that show that the current generation in their 20s will have 2, 3, 4 significant careers rather than just the one. And I know just anecdotally keeping touch with people that it seems to be that a lot of paramedics are doing the, you know, the 6, 7, 8 year stint and then moving on to, you know, for a lot other areas within healthcare, but stepping off the front line. Now, that could, we'll see in some years' time, that could show a decrease overall in the amount of people that have served on the front line developing these level of issues simply because their volume of exposure has been reduced, certainly in the time that they're in. The nature of the exposure will be the same. You know, they'll be seeing these sentinel events, but the self-care, I guess, of being aware that I don't think I can do this for 40 years, so I will look at transitioning into something else.
I think you're right. I think with the more awareness of the longer term impacts of the work, the more people might look at it in terms of, okay, this is something you do for 5 to 7 to 10 years, but the longer you do it, the more the risk. A bit of a difficult question, but when you look at the psychological price you've had to pay to do the work that you've done, and then you look at all of the massive contribution you've made to society in the 40 years that you've been doing this work, how would you describe, in doing the work, you've had to go through what you've gone through? Has it been worth it? Would you do it again?
I'm going to paraphrase. I think it was a sports person. I heard this quote, and I'll probably butcher it a bit, but when asked exactly that, would you do it all again? No, I wouldn't do it again, but I'm pleased and proud to have had the opportunity to have done it once. I don't regret my history, the warts and all. I've met and worked with some amazing people, just incredible. And again, another phrase that gets used by a lot of police colleagues and ambulance is that we have had, for the duration of our career, front row center seats to the greatest show on earth. I've had some amazing, hysterically funny things happen. I've delivered, I worked it out a while ago, it was something like 32 children over the time, and every single one of them went textbook. So, you know, that's a hell of a buzz. That's a real positive. I don't know whether any of them have been named Don, but that's... When people talk about the negative side, you know, the downside, and there's probably a downside to every profession, it is balanced out by some incredible times. I have a number of patients in my mind that they've had an impact on the way I think about life and how it all works. So, no, I don't regret it. No, I don't regret it at all.
And in a way, Don, that's a great message of hope, because what it means is a challenge for all of us. If we can bring support to frontline workers at the right time and when they need it, and that we don't have stigmas about accepting it, that if we can lower your what you've been through and we can lessen, I mean, we'll never eradicate PTSD because we're human, but if we can lower the impact, well, then it'll mean that the what came out of the work is stronger than what the price you paid for it. And, you know, it's a really powerful point. Before we finish, tell me a little bit about, I think, is it K9, the group, the peer support group that you work with?
I'm involved with a group called the Code 9 Foundation.
Code 9, yeah.
And Code 9 is the Victoria Police radio emergency call for police in trouble. So that was the basis of the name. It started off in 2015 as a police support mechanism, and it's grown and developed, and we now have a an online community of about 4,000 people, and we have a number of private social media rooms for them. We look after, we have for partners and carers, for the members themselves, and we have a public page. And in we're a registered charity, and in real time, we if people are really struggling with their mental or physical health or a combination of both, in the short term, we have an arrangement with a group called Chef Good, who provide meals for us for a couple of weeks at a time, house cleaning, firewood for those in the country that need it, home maintenance, gardening. We provide practical assistance to help remove burdens on people if they're physically or mentally not in a good spot. Simply mowing the lawn or vacuuming the house may seem insurmountable, and that will compound or can compound their mental health issues, whereas something as simple as us organising a local mowing mob or a cleaning group to come through for paying for a couple of hours' labour, the compounding effect of positive effect of that on the individual is huge. So that's what we do. And also Code 9 Foundation is tied in with Assistance Dogs Australia, who provide assistance dogs to not only those with PTSD, but people with physical disability, autism, children, all those sorts of issues. One assistance dog for the lead to be placed in the hand of the ultimate team member. The dog and the person are a team. For that lead to be handed over, ends up that the cost is about $40,000. And each year for the last couple of years now, as we've grown, Code 9 has provided that funding to ADA, so that they've been able to work another dog up. And I've been fortunate enough that I myself have a dog through Assistance Dogs Australia. His name's Bernie. I've had him for about 18 months, and he's had an incredible positive effect on my life. He was the absolute final booster rocket, I think, for want of a better phrase, and in the 18 months I've had him, my primary medication has been reduced by 50%, and two fairly significant medications that impact on your daily capacity to do things are totally gone now.
Wow. So Don, has that given you a sense that with Bernie that it almost sounds like it's accelerated the recovery, you know?
Yes. Yeah, it has. He's made an incredible difference. I would get quite quite overwhelming anxiety episodes. And one of the medications that I was able to get rid of completely was an anxiolytic medication. If I start to feel an anxiety episode coming on, he's only ever two or three paces away from me at any given point in time. So I'm able to draw on him. He comes in, he recognises the triggers, and he just sort of hooks up and, looks after me. If he picks up that I'm not how I should be, he'll often come and start to bump his head into me, which he's a Bernese mountain dog of some 60 kilos. So when he hits you with his head, it's pretty hard to stay distracted. So, he's made a huge difference. My family have always been a great support, and they've been fantastic too. So I do count myself fortunate that I have a home environment and Bernie that basically keeps me moving towards a positive place all the time.
And I guess in a way, Bernie is always there so that you're not alone when that anxiety
hits.
Whereas if you didn't have Bernie and you're home alone in the house, and you would be on your own. And people often tell me that's the anxiety is really, you need someone there with you to help you to bring it down. And and Bernie does that. And I'm sure the walks are long and vigorous by the 60-kilo dog tagging you along.
Well, 60-kilo dog, he actually doesn't like walking too far or too fast, which actually suits me. So, we do okay.
Yeah. Well, look, I can't thank you enough, Don, for sharing your story. And I'm absolutely sure that a lot of people will relate to it. And, a lot of frontline workers that have been through or are going through what you've been through. And I think that message of, do talk, do access that help that's there. And a lot of people like yourself, know what it's like, you understand what you go through, and that it can be got through. And so it's just a great message. So I can't thank you enough. And it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me on this latest episode of Trauma from the Frontline. If you are enjoying this series, please make sure you follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts. And if you find this information valuable, we ask that you rate the show 5 stars. If you would like to get in touch with me, please feel free to email me at bruce@letstalkdifferently.com.au. Until the next episode, please take care. If this episode has raised any issues for you, free counselling is available through your organisation's employee assistance provider, Lifeline on 131 114 or Beyond Blue on 1300 224 636.